Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. This week, we're examining the outlook for global markets at a time of severe uncertainty. I'm David Thorpe, Special Projects Editor at FT Advisor. Inflation and maybe even stagflation are preoccupying investors' minds right now, but advisors and their clients also have to contend with pandemic uncertainty, interest rate risk, and the ever-present impact of technological change on portfolios. But what are the options and possible safe harbors for clients at this time? Joining me to discuss the topic are Simon King, Chief Investment Officer at Vermeer Partners, Simon Edelston, Global Equity Fund Manager at Artemis, and Stephen Bell, Portfolio Manager and Chief Economist at BMO Global Asset Management. Thank you all for joining me today. Simon King, if we start with you, given the unusual nature of the pandemic-induced recession and recovery, how confident can we be on a global basis that economies and asset prices will react as they usually do in periods of economic recovery when exiting recessions?
Thank you, David. In short, not very. We believe we're at a very different starting point than we've been in previous cycles. We've come out of this unprecedented period from sort of 2008 to 2020, where you've had asset classes being very highly correlated. You could argue, you know, we have a lucky generation of investors who've invested, as long as they've been invested in some sort of market, have tended to make money. So trying to anticipate the behaviour of those is going to be very difficult. If you then throw into the equation that, again, we're coming out of this unprecedented period of quantitative easing, the differences that COVID is going to make in the medium and longer terms in terms of supply and demand, which I'm sure we'll come to, and indeed inflation, which you mentioned in your preamble there. So our view as we move into undoubtedly a period of, you know, tapering and interest rate rises, there are going to be many bubbles that will be burst. We just don't know which ones they are or indeed when that's going to occur.
Thank you. Stephen, from an economics point of view and wearing your economist hat, how have you... How does one view economic data right now? So many data points seem extreme or seem like outliers, but do we know where the mean is yet? Can we understand that? Do we know what's an economic cycle in a world of monetary policy as it is?
Well, clearly the pandemic was a collapse in supply and demand that is unprecedented in peacetime. And the recovery, you know, both the recession and the recovery have been historically very sharp. When it comes to how asset prices will react, in one sense, it's the same. What we look for in the stock market is for earnings and the discount rate by which you bring those back to present value, as well as sustainability, inflation, monetary policy outlook. It's just that we have had a unique, again, in peacetime, change in supply. So we have a very far from full recovery in employment, still 5 million short of the pre-COVID level of employment in the United States, but there are labour shortages. We have shortages all over the place, and that's due to the incredible turmoil that's been occasioned by this pandemic. The speed of the recovery caught people out. And, of course, we now find ourselves analysing medical data in a way that we never did before. And I was at a dinner last night where we were discussing that epidemiologists' job is to make economic forecasters look good. And we recognise that their forecasts are pretty inaccurate.
Great. Well, Simon Edelston, as an equity guy, you probably have fewer options than Simon King as Chief Investment Officer. He can go into other asset classes, etc. And Stephen can be the economic forecaster who can, who can do that stuff. But as the equity guy, you've only got one game in town to play with. How do you think about it right now?
From a global equity point of view, there have been some classic recovery features, I suppose you'd say, dated back to when the vaccines came out and when President Biden got elected, so both last November, and you had a fairly classic period of recovery stocks doing their recovery thing, it was hard for them not to. If you are a restaurant or pub company, a hotel company, and you went from having no customers and closed to open, you're going to see your earnings going up pretty fast. But that was a feature of the first quarter. The odd thing from an equity fund manager's point of view is an economic point. We're still very, very early in a recovery. The recovery has been reasonably vigorous. But normally in a recession, you have plenty of what Keynes used to call excess capacity left over. You didn't normally get inflationary pressures. What are we now? 18 months into a recovery. So unfortunately, from what we're looking at the moment, the recovery is starting to peter out a little bit in terms of vigor. More so in Europe and Asia, perhaps. China's had a significant slowdown than America, which seems to be pretty good. And we're facing inflationary pressures, energy prices, labor pressures, incredibly early in the recovery. So now you've got to judge how much recovery you're going to get and whether you're going to get paid for it in terms of whether those extra sales are going to get eaten up by cost pressures on businesses. And that's much, much earlier in the cycle than it would be in a classic cycle.
Thank you. And Simon Edison, we'll stick with you for the next question as well. Do you regard inflation as the biggest threat to equity market returns in the next year or two?
Following very naturally from my last remark, absolutely. But you can pick your stocks. So if you're in a business which has got a lot of labor input, a lot of fuel input into it, an equity analyst has got to do a very careful calculation of whether those cost pressures are going to be bigger or smaller or the same as any recovery you see. But there are loads of other companies out there which just don't have those issues. Now, rather boringly for people who've followed equities over the last 12 years, the companies which classically don't have particularly big energy costs, particularly big labor costs, are the same technology shares which have done most of the running in the stock market for the last 12 years. It's not an answer a lot of people want to have. A lot of people want to say, oh, this is a time where you sell all those stocks that have done well the last 12 years and you go off into more cyclical stocks, what some people call value stocks, though that's a very loosely used term. But one can look at some of the stocks which have been left behind by the market, look at the challenges on the inflation front and actually get more worried about them now. Weak companies with a lot of debt, a lot of input cost pressures, they're probably not going to see their earnings recover or their cash flows recover. And so they may look much cheaper, but for in our opinion anyway, that's not going to be the easy way to make money over the next few years, because we could be facing inflation without that bigger recovery driver. That's the problem. And that's what's really changed since the spring. In the spring, we were looking at the recovery producing the inflation. Now it looks like the inflation's here, but it's not being produced by the recovery. It's being produced by us underpaying truck drivers for decades, for instance. This is a global phenomenon. This is not just a UK phenomenon. We've got port congestion in almost every country in the world. We've got supply chain disruption almost everywhere. And on the other hand, I'll just say, and it's also quite a good thing that less well-paid people, younger people also are going to get a pay rise. It's been long overdue. So there are good points as well as bad points, but one does have to duck and weave, pick your stocks, pick your areas to invest in very carefully.
Thank you. Simon King, as Chief Investment Officer, you're obviously an asset allocator. You don't have to like equities, what do you regard as the biggest threat across all of the different asset classes? Is inflation the thing that keeps you awake at night?
Yes, most definitely. I'd certainly agree with everything that Simon said there in terms of your sort of ability to stock pick within the equity space. And as in any phase of economic development, there'll be winners and losers. Obviously, it's all of our collective jobs to try and find those winners. Inflation is our biggest concern at the moment. It's going to force people to focus on real rates of return, which is something they've not had to do for some time. We think inflation is much worse, even as we speak, and it's going to deteriorate quicker and to higher levels than certainly the market, and more importantly, central banks and politicians think at the moment. It's going to have pretty big socio and economic impact in our view because of that, the scale of that. You know, one of the issues of the last decade is that, you know, the wealth divergence has increased, and inflation is going to only make that situation worse. We're also faced with a problem that both consumers and sort of market participants have very little experience of inflation. You have to go back so far for people to actually remember the true effects of it, you know, literally into the 1970s. That I think, again, it's going to be difficult for us to anticipate how, you know, how people react to it. We get very frustrated about this whole transitory versus permanent argument. To us, it's irrelevant. As I said, it's here right now, it's major, and it's making people poorer on a daily basis at quite a quick rate. And then the, you know, the last point I would make is it's a nightmare for policymakers, in our view, because it's injected another sort of unknown variable into a situation which they're already struggling with. So it's going to make it very difficult as they start to taper, as they start to raise rates, to really understand, you know, the impact of the policy actions they're making.
Thank you. Stephen, can one, given, you know, all we've said about the unusual nature of the recovery and given how hard it is to measure, for example, the impact of technological change on a wider economy, is the inflation picture as clear cut as perhaps it looks now in terms of being on the supply side more than the demand side? And is it as big a threat as maybe many market participants are pricing?
Well, I think it is a threat. It's very obvious. And we see this most clearly in the United States, where we had a first wave of bottleneck pressures that the Federal Reserve could argue were temporary, cars being the obvious one, which fed through to rental prices, car rental prices. But it's lasted a lot longer, even in those sectors, than expected. Transport costs, we measure these things quite easily. But we're now getting a second wave, which is far more persistent, which is rents, shelter, measured in a way that makes them persistent. But at a very simple level, if the market rate for rent doubled today, it would take a year if everyone had a one-year lease before rents went up. So it's clearly persistent for all kinds of reasons. And the second one is wages. It's very hard to measure wages when compositional effects are powerful. And they're never more powerful than they are at the moment, where, you know, in the United States, 20 million people got fired and they're being rehired. And of course, they tend to be lower paid, and that affects the average. So there's a measure that the Atlanta Fed do that basically adjusts for all that, or was rather not affected by them. And that's accelerated. And that's part of the reason why the Fed have done a swerve in terms of their, oh, it's transitory, oh, it's not. And the only thing that I would add to that is, whilst I do see inflation as a threat, the bigger threat to me is real interest rates. We've got this extraordinary situation where 10-year real interest rates in the United States, as measured by TIPS, are minus 1% at a time when the government deficit is the biggest it's been in peacetime and shows no sign of being reined in, as we're discussing budget bills, you know, in Washington at the moment. So here we have this global synchronized fiscal boom, an economic recovery, and real interest rates apparently negative. It's a curious combination. And to go back to Simon Edelson's very well argued point about tech companies not having much exposure to energy prices or wage costs, they certainly have exposure to higher real interest rates because they are by definition stocks that return earnings in the future. And if you discount something that's going up in line inflation by a negative number, you get a very good valuation. And I think we have to recognize that that is a threat. If that minus one were to become plus one, which still wouldn't be outrageous, that would be quite a big change in how you value all assets, actually. Well, most assets, but certainly the ones with much longer duration. So I think it's a combination. And they're just the known threats. Never mind, you know, the virus, which we talk about. There's always something else. The thing that really stymies a market tends to be something that we didn't see. But for the things we know, the known unknowns, they're the two, I think.
Thank you. Simon King, I'm coming to you first on this question because again, you're an asset allocator, a multi-asset person. Given the unprecedented nature and extent of the monetary policy response, but to the pandemic crisis, but actually to the global financial crisis as well, do we need to think differently about risk and how to price risk in a world where bond yields have been so low, or interest rates are at a 5,000-year low, if you want to call it that? And actually, even if interest rates go up next month, they'd still, within the margin of error, be at a 5,000-year low.
I mean, I think in terms of our actual assessment of risk, that, you know, theoretically, there should be no change, and that markets should have been doing that over the previous 10 or 15 years, as I say, which has been an unusual period. However, I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence that the market overall has simply become too sanguine, lazy, relaxed. You can pick your own adjective, but certainly we think risk has been underestimated and certainly underpriced for some time. So, I mean, the problem will be, as I say, this is uncharted territory for everybody. I mean, there is no dummy's guide to QE tapering and simultaneous rate rises, because we've never had to do it before. You know, and as I mentioned before, there are going to be all sorts of unintended consequences, you know, which we'll only see as we are unwind. But, I mean, you know, our hope is that at least central governments start to get on with it. There's been a lot of talk, and as I said earlier, inflation won't help in them making the decisions to finally start tapering. You know, but in our view, you can't keep feeding the junkie methadone forever. You've got to get him off it at some point.
Thank you for that, Simon. I think that's going to be in the headline when this gets published. and that's unusual, because normally it's Simon Edelston that produces the headline line for me. But
he's got time.
Stephen, we'll come to you for, I mean, that question. How does one think about risk at a portfolio level in a world where we have monetary policy doing what it's doing? You've talked about the discount rate, for example. It's never been that low before. Does one need to think about risk in a different way?
Well, I've got a view about risk, which is the biggest mistake you could make is not to try and measure your risk. And the second biggest mistake is to believe the measure once you've got it. And I have lots of measures of risk for my own portfolio, and I plot time series for that measure, and it moves around all over the place. So even if you use the same risk engine, it gives a different answer every day. And that's not to even think about the risk, the whole risk world changing. And obviously, we've had a massive change over time in the structure of economies and the international relations of economies, the central bank reaction function, the fiscal reaction function. Many of these things change. And you just have to recognize that you just have to make your best effort to measuring risk, and you'll never get the right answer. Just have to keep thinking about it. And ultimately, I'm fortunate that I deal in highly liquid markets. I'm not in a situation where my market, although it didn't, some of the markets nearly froze, even the most liquid ones. But generally speaking, if you can liquidate your portfolio relatively quickly, then your P&L is your risk measure. And when that starts going south, you need to get very scared. So yes, the world has changed. Yes, the risks are different. But I don't think that the world has changed in a completely dramatic way any more than it was in the global financial crisis, which in my rather long career, it was the biggest change in the world, when banks were going bust and top names, the very best of names, were being turned down in the repo market. That was a world where I really didn't expect to see. And of course, this is another world which is dramatically different. But it's just, you know, every few decades, the world changed. I mean, the inflation problem we have in prospect is tiny compared with the 70s, where, again, things changed in a way that people had never seen at the global level before. Obviously, we've had hyperinflations, but we haven't had the industrialized world experiencing inflation that they did in the 1970s. So every few decades is a completely unprecedented shock that we have to grapple with.
Thank you. Simon Edelston, within the context of the equity portfolios that you run, and do you think about risk differently? What constitutes a higher risk equity position now? Is that different to what it might have been when you started your career? Stephen mentioned he's had rather a long career. I think it's fair to say you've had you didn't start yesterday either.
No, I'm afraid not. Yes, a few people have mentioned how one has to think back to, how few people may have experienced inflation and the real cost of it. I think it's important to get the, on the one hand, to remember how few people are experienced or have had recent experience of these sorts of conditions. And then secondly, but to get in context quite how big they are, we are talking about 5% inflation today in America, or 5 and a bit, that people are worried might go up to, 6, 7, 8? When I started, I think inflation was 13 or 14% in the UK, having been over 20. So, you know, it's not quite that. The trouble is, as both Simon King and Stephen have referred to, we start from this bizarre situation that has only turned up in the last 10 years, where interest rates are miles below the level of inflation. So the bond yield is the worry. The bond yield is where it is as a leftover from the 2008 financial crisis. It's been put there to reflect where central banks want the bond yield to be. And it is not there to reward savers for or compensate savers for inflation. So are there any lessons that we can learn about what happens when the central banks try to start removing the methadone? There are very few. I'm afraid that the one great example is the Japanese, who started their QE 10 years before everyone else, because they had a financial crisis in the late 90s. And some would say that the Japanese have tried to reduce QE now 3 or 4 times in the last 20 years and have always given up. The methadone has always gone back. Whenever they try to put it out of the economy, they end up with deflation, which is hardly a problem at the moment, it has to be said. But actually also the financial markets just panic, give them a kicking, and they retreat. And they've had recently higher levels of QE than they've ever had in 20 years. And they didn't have a bad financial crisis, by the way, not compared with the UK and America in terms of banks blowing up. So we're in for this period. We've been told that the QE, the tapering is going to happen in America. I think between here and February, we'll be able to see how the markets react. I mean, the bond market knows it's coming, and 10-year bond yields in America have gone from 126 to 178 in a month. I mean, it's hardly headline news, and it hasn't bothered the equity market. But from an equity person's point of view, yeah, I'm not going to pretend that highly priced stocks trading on DCFs will not take a wobble at this point. And certainly I think that some of the stocks whose profits are all 5-10 years in the future are going to see severe pressure in their ratings. The funny thing about some of the biggest tech stocks is they've actually caught up. Their cash flows have caught up with their share prices in recent years. They have actually grown pretty fast. So companies like Microsoft and Google these days, they have PEs. They may not have yields, they may not pay tax, but they do actually have PEs. So it's not like they're just trading on earnings decades out. But there are plenty of other stocks which can get through this period. But yeah, I mean, safety first, absolutely, in an equity portfolio over the next 6 months, in my view.
Thank you. Simon King, you've both yourself and Simon Elliston have referred to the big tech stocks and the business models they have and the way those things have traditionally grown, which involves hiring more people rather than buying more plant and machinery or opening more factories, for example. Does that different business model, that different way of expanding, mean that traditional valuation metrics, such as price earnings, may be less valid for big tech than companies that were the biggest companies of the past? For example, when Henry Ford wanted to expand his car making empire, he had to open a factory and buy loads of machinery. That gets depreciated in accounts over a number of years. When Google want to expand, they hire a load of tech people, and that 100% of the cost goes onto the P&L straight away, which means that they look maybe slightly less profitable than they are. Is that something that we need to think? Does that mean that valuation metrics don't work?
Simple answer, no. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with the valuation metrics that the majority of the market employs. The issue is that most people don't listen to the output and choose to, you know, ignore the warning signals. So I don't think it's a case that we're in this sort of new paradigm or it's different this time around, you know, which is the usual refrain from the, you know, the mega bulls in the market. You know, particularly equities, but you know, you can employ the same techniques across other asset classes. I mean, it's still about profit, it's still about returns, and it's still about cash flow. I mean, those are the key issues. I mean, on tech in particular, I mean, I think unfortunately the market tends to put everything in one large bucket. And, you know, there are two very different types of big tech. There are the stocks that Simon mentioned there. You know, they, I mean, in our view, these are becoming the new blue chips, because as of yet, we've been unable to actually come up with a set of the market conditions in which they underperform. So, I mean, actually, you know, financially and operationally, and as Simon said, I mean, they've grown stratospherically. Their cash flows have indeed grown into their ratings, and you could argue have gone past them. So we are not particularly concerned about those. However, at the other end of the spectrum, we are very concerned about things that have literally infinite valuations, very, very high actual valuations in terms of market cap, and particularly those companies that are still loss-making. The big difference, you know, when you compare this tech rally to, you know, 2000, which I am an old enough, unfortunately, to have been around for, is the market's propensity to fund losses. It didn't happen in 2000, which is why the fall was so sharp. This time round, the very, very large losses have been funded by various participants. If we do move into a tapering, general lessening of liquidity, deleveraging, call it what you will, then I think these models are going to be severely tested. And in our view, there will be, you know, a number of zeros around in that sector. So people are going to lose a lot of money from this point. In our view, that's very healthy for the market. You know, we need to get back to sorting the wheat from the chaff. You know, this rising tide we have where, you know, it's literally carried all ships is long overdue a correction in our view.
Thank you. Stephen, are we in this new paradigm? Do we think about things differently because the business models are so different, because it's all technology and the old rules don't apply?
I mean, it's certainly the case that these technology companies have a business model that's unusual, network effects and so forth and so on. Funnily enough, a lot of the issues for economists trying to measure things and the business models are, in the United States at any rate, a bit like TV companies. Their output could be multiplied, and it was the consumer who bought the TV set, and they just had more and more audience. Their service was free at the point of use, as much of the you know, Google and so forth. But they made their money from advertising. But they were a much smaller share of the overall market than we have now for these companies who are capital light and actually labor light. But, you know, there's always a change in the structure of the stock market. Go back 20 years at any period, you'll have seen that, you know, 20 years previously, there were a lot of companies around that aren't around, or the big companies are just not there anymore. So I think there's always been this change. And I think that the fundamentals, as both Simons have said, of, you know, earnings, cash flow, discounts, I mean, that's really what valuations are about. And the big uncertainty is, as I say, coming back to what level of bond yields we're going to end up with in a few years' time. And I think there's more uncertainty about that. Well, if you knew what that was, you'd have a better idea about what the stock market's going to be. And I didn't ever expect that with the size of budget deficits, the level of inflation, that you'd have nominal bond yields at this level. If you told me that this set of economic circumstances were existing, I'd have just not believed you, even if 5 years ago. But it's a curious combination, a set of circumstances that would normally be expected with rising, ever-rising bond yields, uncontrollable bond yields, has got these very well-behaved level of bond yields. And if it's all due to Chinese saving, that's retreating as a dampening influence. But we have to be a bit humble and recognize that if we didn't expect things to end up here, we can hardly predict with any confidence where they're going to go.
Thank you. Simon Edison, you've spoken in your earlier remarks with some positivity around the investment case for some of those large tech companies, but is it a new paradigm, or is it that they're just becoming grown-ups?
Well, they're very unusual companies in how profitable they are, but also how strong their balance sheets are, and they have a massive return on invested capital compared with traditional companies. And as Stephen's pointed out, they're a very large chunk of the global index these days. So the one other comment I'd make, a lot of people like rolling out charts of equities versus bonds going over decades. They're very popular. But of course, if you take the equity market index from the last time there was inflation, 20 years ago, 30 years ago now, 40 years ago, I suppose, the big companies in the world were Exxon and General Electric and General Motors. And they all had one thing in common, massive amounts of debt. The big companies in the world these days had one thing in common, massive amounts of cash. The other thing they had in common was very, very low margins and rather high exposure to rising energy and labor costs. The big companies these days just don't. So if the ratio of valuations of an equity market to the bond market looks a bit high to equities, one could explain it just by saying, well, those equities can cope with much more adverse economic circumstances than equities could on average in the past. And yet you look at the valuation of equities, equity markets at the moment yield a lot more than bond markets. Whereas in those days, equity markets used to yield a lot less than bond. So that seems to me to be completely the wrong way round. You know, if the average yield of equities, which at least give you some sort of protection from inflation because they're real assets, and that's a bigger argument. But if the average yield gives you a better running yield, despite these companies investing for growth, than the bond market, that's not a world where I'm going to worry about equities. I'm going to worry about bonds a lot before I worry about equities.
Thank you. Okay, guys, last question and relatively brief answers, please. How can an investor think about and prepare at a portfolio level for esoteric risk, whether that's something even madder happening in the political world or a public health emergency? How can one do that, or does one just have to wait for it to happen? Stephen Bell, it's probably appropriate to start with you for that one.
I think you've always got to be flexible in your understanding of what the drivers are. Obviously, this pandemic has been a dramatic deviation. I've never spent weeks listening to vaccinologists as a guide to investment before. So that's the first point, is be flexible and be nimble and just try and make sense of a world that's increasingly complicated. That's the way that I like to do it. And I think one of the advantages from an investing point of view is when the world is in turmoil, there are more opportunities. You know, you can think very sadly of the ill effects of this turmoil, whether it's a natural disaster or an economic disaster. But it creates opportunities. Things get mispriced. And one of the most extraordinary opportunities last March was the Treasury market started falling apart, which was very unusual. So I think there's always an upside to difficulties in financial markets.
Thank you, Simon King. How would you think about that? Is it something that you can think about at a portfolio level?
I mean, you can. Our issue with esoteric, I think the definition means that at least someone understands it. I would go as far to say as at the moment, no one understands it. So, you know, trying to second guess that, I think is, you know, a foolish approach. And indeed, I mean, if you look back, I mean, you could have been very bearish on COVID when it started and obviously proven to be very right. And if you'd gone bearish on the market, you would have lost a lot of money. So you can spend a lot of time trying to figure it out, but you're also trying to figure out the way that other people are going to react to it, and that's a very difficult task. I mean, I think in terms of portfolios, and certainly what we recommend to clients at the moment, you just have to run a balanced approach, which is something we've done for the last 2 years, and I see no reason to change that at the moment.
Thank you. And Simon Edelston, as the equity guy, you're probably on the, you equity guys are on the front line if this, if something esoteric happens, because the other guys, I suppose, can do bonds, gold, cash, etc. But you're right there. How do you think about that question?
I'm delighted I can't, because, you know, from what I see, I mean, the really heartwarming thing about the last 5 years has been how well the companies that we've selected for the portfolio have done, despite the following: Trump, the pandemic, interest rates being set at a bizarre level, a bit of inflation, and China going quite a way back towards being a bit more left-wing. I mean, the companies are amazing things. That, you know, well-run companies have proved their mettle, and I'd stick with them.
Thank you very much for that, Simon Edelston, and thank you to Stephen Bell, Chief Economist at BMO Global Asset Management, Simon King, Chief Investment Officer at Vermeer Partners, and Simon Edelston, Global Equity Fund Manager at Artemis. And thank you all for listening. Tune in next week for the next edition of the FT Advisor Podcast.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.